Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the Republican presidential candidates piling on after their frontrunner has so brazenly insulted Latino voters, joining Trump in calling for an end to birthright citizenship that would mean repealing the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Paul Waldman, a weekly columnist and senior writer for The American Prospect, who also writes for the Plumline blog at The Washington Post, where his latest article is, "Did Republicans Just Give Away the 2016 Election by Raising Birthright Citizenship?" joins us. We will discuss the apparently suicidal tendency the GOP is exhibiting by alienating the fastest growing demographic in the country while threatening to change the Constitution, which is an empty gesture they cannot deliver on. Then we'll look into flibanserin, the so-called female Viagra pill that the FDA just approved after having rejected it twice before. Dr. Susan Wood, a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health, joins us to discuss the power of Big Pharma in pushing this pill that will not work for the vast majority of women who might take it to improve their sex lives, while exposing them to dangerous side effects like dizziness and nausea, and in some cases leading to fainting and blackouts. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of what seems to be a lackluster presidential campaign by Hillary Clinton, who, while leading in the polls, is being seriously challenged by Bernie Sanders on her left, while on the right, the Clinton scandal machine keeps pumping out negative headlines that the press dutifully parrots. David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report, who was a White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, joins us to discuss what needs to be done to revive and focus Hillary Clinton's second campaign for the presidency. And joining us now is Paul Waldman, a weekly columnist and senior writer for The American Prospect. He also writes the Plumline blog at The Washington Post and The Week, and is the author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. His latest article at The Washington Post is, Did Republicans Just Give Away the 2016 Election by Raising Birthright Citizenship? Welcome to Background Briefing, Paul Waldman.
Thank you.
And the fact that Donald Trump came out with his immigration plan, which includes an end to birthright citizenship, after his opening salvo, when he actually announced his candidate, he said the most outrageous and insulting things about Latinos. So you'd think, could you do any worse with Latinos? But what's amazing is a lot of the rest of the Republican presidential primary field seemed to have jumped onto the Trump bandwagon.
They did, and they don't really know how to deal with Trump, and they go back, kind of back and forth between trying to distance themselves from him and trying to emulate him. And this issue of immigration and the Latino vote is absolutely critical. There may be no more important challenge that the Republicans have in 2016 than how to improve among Latino voters, because the fact of the matter is America is becoming less white. And Latinos are now the largest minority group, and they're growing, as are Asian Americans. And if the Republicans do not improve their standing among Latino voters, they simply cannot win the White House. It is mathematically impossible. And so what we see now is, instead of trying to reach out to Hispanic voters and trying to win them over, as Republicans keep saying that they're going to do, they're actually moving in the opposite direction. And this issue of birthright citizenship is incredibly damaging to them. To actually say to people that people who are born in the United States, and since the Civil War, everyone born in the United States is automatically an American citizen since the 14th Amendment was passed, to say that we are now going to say it's not a matter of where being born here, it's about who your parents are, and if you don't have the right parents, you're not going to get to be an American citizen, that is going to alienate every single Latino voter in the United States, and it will be a disaster if they keep going down this road.
So in your article, you mentioned some of the names, apart from Donald Trump, who have questioned or even suggested ending birthright citizenship. And that's Scott Walker, Bobby Jindal, John Kasich, Rand Paul, Chris Christie, Lindsey Graham, and Rick Santorum. Frankly, the one name that surprises me in that is John Kasich, because he came across in the first debate as being a fairly reasonable guy.
Yeah, but a few years ago, when he ran for governor, this is an issue that came up, and he said that he would consider ending birthright citizenship. And it's an idea that's been kind of percolating around on the fringes of Republican thought for some time now. And some of those candidates are more emphatic about it than others. You know, Bobby Jindal yesterday tweeted out, and this is a quote, "We need to end birthright citizenship for illegal immigrants." Some of the other ones, when asked, have said, well, that's something we should look at, we should explore it, maybe we ought to. But the fact is you now have almost half of the Republican field, which is enormous, 8 out of the 17 candidates have at least said that they're willing to entertain this as part of the solution to the immigration problem. And so one of the questions is, it's one thing if somebody who is one of those 8 becomes the nominee and then has to deal with it directly, but even if it's one of the other people, you know, today, for instance, Jeb Bush and Marco Rubio, when this came up, both said that they didn't think that we ought to end birthright citizenship, and, you know, you may think that's natural. You know, Bush's wife is a Mexican immigrant, Rubio's parents are Cuban immigrants. So one of the questions is, let's say it's one of those candidates who's a little more friendly toward immigrants, is the fact that their policies are not that much different from the other Republican candidates going to have the same effect, even if they personally don't send that same kind of message of hostility? And that's a real open question. I don't think anybody yet knows the answer to it. But it's still going to be extremely dangerous. I mean, if you think about it, Mitt Romney won 27% of the Latino vote, according to exit polls. According to some of the analyses that have been done, the Republican candidate in 2016 is going to have to get at least 40% of the Latino vote, and probably more, if he's going to have any chance of winning. And so they have to do significantly better. Not just as good as their prior candidates have done, but significantly better among Latino voters if they're going to have any chance to win.
And again, I'm speaking with Paul Waldman, who's a weekly columnist and senior writer for The American Prospect. He also writes for the Plum Lion blog at The Washington Post and The Week, and is the author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. And his latest article at The Washington Post is Did Republicans Just Give Away the 2016 Election by Raising Birthright Citizenship? Now, but raising it, of course, is one thing, but actually overturning the 14th Amendment would require a constitutional amendment is a very, very high bar. And as you mentioned, this was established by the 14th Amendment to the Constitution, and it was settled by the Supreme Court in 1989. And the language of the 14th Amendment itself is extremely unambiguous. It says all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. So this seems like double jeopardy. You're shooting yourself in the foot, and at the end of the day, you can't even do what you promised.
Yeah, anytime you hear a presidential candidate announce that they propose a constitutional amendment to do almost anything, and this is true of Democrats and Republicans alike, you know, Hillary Clinton has said she'd like to see some kind of a constitutional amendment that would overturn Citizens United. Anytime you see that, they're not being realistic. Because the fact is, it's just extraordinarily difficult to amend the Constitution. And it's particularly hard when you're talking about a matter that's at all controversial. And this would obviously be extraordinarily controversial. And so there's no way that it's actually going to happen. But the question is, do you do the political damage to yourself anyway by raising it? And, you know, this gets back to the sort of central quandary that Republicans have. Their base, the people that their candidates are trying to appeal to now in order to win the nomination, are very much opposed to undocumented immigration. They want harsh measures that crack down. They're not interested in comprehensive immigration reform. And yet, at the same time, the people in the party know that in order to win the White House, they do have to be more welcoming to, not only do they have to be more welcoming to Hispanics, but they also have to show moderate voters, white voters, black voters, all kinds of voters, that they are not as sort of harsh and unforgiving and cruel as some people would make them out to be. So they have this quandary. They need to appeal to those base voters who want to hear tough talk on immigration, but yet they also don't want to alienate the voters they're going to need in the general election. And this is something that Republicans have been grappling with for years. You know, why has there been no comprehensive immigration reform in Congress? Well, the reason is that the people who populate Congress, well, the Republicans, they tend to come from very conservative districts. And so if you are, let's say, a Republican congressman from, let's just say, Missouri, the chances are that even if you understand that your party needs to be more welcoming to Hispanics, and passing a comprehensive reform is a big part of that, just to show them that you are more welcoming, even if you get that's important for Republicans as a whole, your constituents don't want comprehensive immigration reform. And you probably don't want it personally either, because people who get elected in those districts are extremely conservative. And so you have all of these members of Congress who, when the idea comes up, they just say, no, my constituents don't want it, I don't want it, and you know, the fact that it would be good for the Republican Party as a whole, well, that's not as important to me. And so that's the reason why comprehensive immigration reform has gone nowhere in Congress, is because the members of the Republican Party there, it's not in their interest and they don't want it. And so you see a similar kind of thing playing out in the presidential campaign, where they need to appeal to those base voters who are not interested in comprehensive reform. And yet they also want to be able to turn around once the primaries are over and say to the general election voters, oh, yes, I do favor comprehensive reform.
Well, you've written, Paul Wolman, and made a comparison between Jeb Bush and Mitt Romney. Quite frankly, a lot of it sort of jumps out at you. You know, the fact that they had fathers who they respected, if not worshipped. They represent the establishment. They had tons of money behind them. They're not liked by the Tea Party base. And Romney had a propensity for reinforcing his weaknesses, as Jeb Bush recently has been doing, explaining how the Iraq War was actually a great idea and we just need to bring back the Bush Doctrine. But you also suggest, in spite of that, that at the end of the day, Jeb Bush might be left standing as these other people drop off, which is exactly what happened to Mitt Romney. All these other clowns fell to the wayside.
Yeah, I mean, if you remember the way that the 2012 Republican primary played out, one kind of ill-prepared candidate after another briefly became the front runner, whether it was Herman Cain or Newt Gingrich or Rick Santorum, and they all flamed out very quickly, and Romney just kind of never went away. You know, he was the establishment choice, he was the guy who had the most money, he just sort of plodded and persisted, and eventually, you know, each one of these candidates showed themselves to be a flash in the pan, and then when it was all over, essentially the Republican electorate said, oh, well, I guess we'll go with you. And that looks to be something like the best case scenario for Jeb Bush. You know, it's obviously a crazy primary right now. You've got 17 candidates. You have the clear leader is, you know, this sort of I don't even know what the most concise way to describe Donald Trump is, but he's a combination of sort of a buffoon and a genius entertainer, and no one seriously thinks that he could actually be the Republican nominee, but he's dominating the race right now. And then you have a bunch of other people who were supposed to be much more compelling than they have turned out to be so far. You know, people like Marco Rubio, you know, I remember a couple of years ago, Time magazine put him on their cover with the words, the Republican Savior, on it. But he's sticking around at something like 6 or 7%. And so you have all of these people who eventually might get their moment in the sun. And Jeb Bush, I think, is the one who has the most money. You know, his super PACs and everything have raised $100 million. And he is sort of the default choice if everything else goes badly. You know, if one after another of these guys flame out, maybe eventually the party will turn back around to Jeb. But, you know, the truth is that, like Mitt Romney, a lot of the base voters mistrust him. They think he's not a real conservative, even though the truth is that Jeb is as conservative as anybody. Mitt Romney really did change his positions on a lot of things, but Jeb has always been extremely conservative. But for better or worse, the major parts of the Republican base don't really believe that. And so it may be that when it's all said and done, he ends up being the person who just kind of hung around the longest and won after Donald Trump flames out and after a couple of other people, you know, win a primary or two. It could be that he ends up being their nominee. And once again, a lot of those Republican base voters would be kind of disgruntled and disappointed.
Well, you point out there that Jeb Bush recently said, I'm the tortoise in the race, but I'm a joyful tortoise. Now, that's a pretty strange concept, a joyful tortoise. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, you know, I think it reminds me of something that Mike Huckabee used to say. I'm not sure if he says it anymore. He used to say, I'm a conservative, but I'm not angry about it. You know, I think that may be sort of what Jeb is getting at, that he's, you know, he's optimistic and joyful, and he's not mad, but he's just going to sort of keep plodding along. And I think that so he's trying to communicate those two different things. And that's something that Republicans always have to show. You know, from when George Bush ran as a compassionate conservative, he convinced the media to say over and over again that he was a different kind of Republican. That's, you know, Republicans need to demonstrate that they're not mean and they're not cruel, tempered with the parts of their party's beliefs that may be more popular about being, you know, a little more aggressive when it comes to foreign affairs and things like that, that they also, you know, don't just want to toss poor people out into the rain, that they're, you know, that they have some compassion. And so that's something that Republicans always need to demonstrate. And I think that Jeb, and you can see that when he talks about an issue like immigration, you know, the actual policies that he's proposing are no different from those of someone like, you know, Scott Walker or anybody else. They're extremely conservative. But he also will say, you know, we need to treat immigrants like human beings, and they're, you know, we don't want to vilify them. And so he tries to put a more humanistic face on what are essentially the same set of policies.
So do you think that Jeb Bush, if he survives this gauntlet with Trump dominating it at the moment and the base all whipped up and not trusting him, even though, as you point out, his record is extremely conservative, assuming he gets through the gauntlet, my understanding is that he can do very well with the Latino audience because he speaks very good Spanish. And Univision, which is, you know, has a huge Latino audience in this country, will have him on all the time. They're very politically quite conservative, except, you know, they're very passionate about immigration issues. So Jeb Bush would be there. He'd be on Univision around the clock, as far as I could see.
Well, that's really the big question. I mean, there are other reasons why he could have real problems. You know, we've seen him run into a lot of trouble talking about the Iraq War, where, you know, he's going to remind everybody that his brother initiated what was essentially the biggest disaster in American foreign policy history. So he has those kinds of liabilities. But the question is, can he with the fact that he's fluent in Spanish and he can go and give interviews in Spanish, the fact that his wife is Mexican and his kids, you know, they speak Spanish at home, is all of that, his ability to say to Latinos, you know, I'm your friend, I'm not someone who is as hostile as the rest of my party looks, is that going to be more important than the policy questions? Because, you know, the Democrats are going to come back and say, yeah, he speaks Spanish, but he doesn't believe anything different than, you know, maybe not Donald Trump, but that the rest of the party, right, the rest of their party believes. And so I don't think we really know the answer yet. My suspicion is that he'll do better than someone like Mitt Romney or John McCain did, but maybe not quite good enough to overcome the sort of basic hole that Republicans are in with Latino voters. But I think it's a real open question. We haven't seen a candidate on the Republican side who was like that before, or frankly, on the Democratic side either. So it's uncharted territory to a certain extent, and we don't really know how those voters are going to respond.
Well, they responded to Yo Soy Jorge Bush. His older brother was very successful with his Spanish ads, even though he doesn't speak as well as Jeb.
That's true. They did, and you know the environment was a little bit different then. He had this sort of compassionate conservative agenda, and he worked hard to show Hispanics that he was friendly to them. But also, you know, the rhetoric over immigration was not quite as venomous as it had been back then. And so, you know, it's 15 years later, and the Republican Party has spent much of that time working hard to alienate those voters. And so the question is, can Jeb overcome that? And like I said, I don't think we really know the answer yet.
Well, Paul Waldman, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Paul Waldman, who's a weekly columnist and senior writer for The American Prospect. He also writes for the Plum Line blog at The Washington Post and The Week, and is the author of Being Right is Not Enough, What Progressives Must Learn from Conservative Success. And his latest article at The Washington Post is, Did Republicans Just Give Away the 2016 Election by Raising Birthright Citizenship? We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back looking into the so-called female Viagra pill that the FDA just approved.
This land is your land, and this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream waters, this land was made for you and me. As I went a-walking.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Susan Wood, a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health. She is Associate Professor of Health Policy and of Environmental and Occupational Health and the Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Susan Wood.
Happy to be here.
And the FDA is poised to approve a flibanserin, the so-called female Viagra pill. That
it's actually just approved it 2 minutes ago.
Oh, it did. Well,
it did.
Breaking news, ladies and gentlemen. So, this is the so-called female Viagra pill, and frankly, I'm astounded because it's been rejected twice before, and the side effects seem to be really so dangerous in some cases, and my understanding is that it's not going to work for what most women, something like 1 in 20 women may get something out of it.
I mean, that's true. This is a product which we have to say, first of all, it's sort of not like Viagra in that Viagra was dealing with a specific, you know, physiological sexual dysfunction in the case of erection disorder. But in this case, we're talking about a desire for sex. And so this is both difficult to diagnose in terms of not only who has this particular disorder and also who could actually benefit from a medication as opposed to other types of therapy or counseling that can help address, you know, other causes of problems with sexual activity. So there's the problem with who could benefit, and then this particular product is one that, as you said, doesn't have much benefit over its placebo effects. It has a pretty good placebo effect, and only a fraction of women above that have any sort of modest benefit above that. So you would have a lot of women who had no benefit whatsoever other than placebo effect, and yet it comes not just with the sort of financial cost and taking a medication every day, but it comes with risks, as you mentioned, quite serious ones, and ones that have serious interactions with things that are quite commonly used, including alcohol. So it's a problem, and as I said, FDA just approved it with a fair number of restrictions. So we now have coming onto the market a product that is not very effective, comes with a significant risks and risks associated with alcohol consumption and other products as well, and now comes with a lot of restrictions in order to be able to use it safely. We have to have a lot of additional restrictions added on top. So I'm not quite sure what to say in terms of what to expect for the future of this product, but I would rather it not have been approved than come out in this fashion, actually.
Well, is this a case of the muscle and power of Big Pharma?
I mean, yes and no. I mean, the company that sponsored it, Sprout, had tried to get this through FDA before, and this is at the level of the scientific reviewers. I don't think of it was a pressure, a political pressure, either to approve or block a drug that we've seen in the past, but rather the company very strategically developed a PR campaign, ginning up, you know, a lot of my most respected colleagues in women's health advocacy who are jumped on the bandwagon of saying it wasn't fair not to have a sexual dysfunction drug for women, and that this was that FDA was acting in a sexist and discriminatory manner, and therefore, this product should be approved. And it was always prefaced with, we're not just supporting one product, but in fact, that's what they were supporting because that's the only product that was pending before the FDA. So it turned into a much more of a PR thing and an advocacy by a subset of women's health advocates who, in my view, were misled by the company into thinking that this was about sexism and sex discrimination and not about safety and effectiveness of a good product, or what we would hope would be a good product.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Susan Wood, a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health. She is Associate Professor of Health Policy and of Environmental and Occupational Health and the Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. So if you can get this drug now, or women can get this drug now on a prescription with all of the various caveats, that reminds me of how much of the drugs that are advertised on television today have these disclaimers that they read at the end, and you, by the time they read the disclaimers, you know, you're going to fall asleep, your right arm's going to drop off, and in some cases you may not survive, etc., etc. You think that nobody would buy these drugs, but they do. So,
well, it's interesting. So the restrictions that I, again, just very quickly read in the press release by FDA, and which I would hope that the you know, reporters will actually talk about what these restrictions are. They are that you have to have a specifically certified prescriber, which, and the prescriber has to provide specific counseling and get you to sign a specific consent form that explains particularly that you should not drink alcohol while using this product at all. And that there are other medications you just shouldn't take as well. And then you can only go to these certain doctors who've gone through this process to become certified and then to get the prescription, and then you can only go to specific pharmacies that have gone through a certification process. The pharmacist will also have to counsel you that you should not drink at all while taking this medication, and can only fill a prescription signed by a certified prescriber. So the restriction, these restrictions are basically making it a very special product. In my view, you know, a better world would be one where we had a safe and effective product that could address the health needs of a definable population of women who could benefit from it. We would know who would benefit from it. They would actually get benefit, and it would have very low risks. And you wouldn't need to go to special doctors and special pharmacies to address the sexual health of women. I think it's actually a little more sort of patronizing to say, you know, you can get Viagra sold on the street corner practically, but a product for women's sexual functioning, you're going to have to go through all these hoops and barriers. That being said, this is a product that I don't want on the market. I don't think should be on the market, easily available. So it's sort of a conundrum. We're in this situation where the choice is between having all of these sort of special treatment of women's sexual health, or we have a product that's unsafe and not very effective, widely available and over-marketed, I'm quite sure.
Well, my understanding, though, of the history of this drug, flibanserin, is that it was originally supposed to be, I think, a sedative, wasn't it?
An antidepressant.
Antidepressant, that's what I mean. Yeah, an antidepressant. And it didn't work. And then in the tests, they found that among some women, it affects serotonin. It's not, as you point out, Viagra actually directs a physical response in men, but this is in the brain, right?
Right. This is brain chemistry we're working on.
Right.
Yeah.
So is that's the history, though? It's
yeah. And so in this case, it was some sort of failed antidepressant. It did not make it through. It didn't make it through even on the first couple of tries at FDA for being a libido product. And, you know, the actual problem here, the barrier, is that, you know, if you're to argue that, you know, we haven't focused our research efforts or our drug development or treatment development for new therapies for women's sexual functioning, that's probably true. And for women who need or have a health problem that could be treated through a medical means, there hasn't been the research and the development to understand what is the nature of the problem, what is the biological and physiological nature of it, how would you develop a drug that would treat the problem. Instead, we're sort of going at this a bit backwards and sort of, you know, always looking for the female Viagra, and there's been looks at hormones, there's been looks at blood flow, and now we're looking at brain chemistry just to find something that can be marketed. It's not doing it through the let's understand it first and come up with a good definition of the problem and a logical way to approach it. So we're dealing with the sort of marketing getting ahead of itself, as we've seen just in the flurry of interest in this. You know, you always put sex and drugs together, and it's going to be a story there. But it's a we want to make. Unfortunately, this is not the product that some would lead us to believe it. They would like it to be.
But in terms of the side effects, the worst and most dangerous would be literally fainting and blacking out. Mm-hmm. Because if you were driving a car or something, that could be fatal. And my understanding is that you could faint or black out on this drug after, you know, maybe not having taken it for a month. I mean, it doesn't mean that just, you know, that it, in other words, the warning says, you know, be careful you don't drive with this drug or something. You know, and if you say to yourself, well, I haven't taken it, and a week later you black out, isn't that incredibly dangerous?
Yeah, I mean, I think the issue I have is that this is a product you take every day, and there are feeling faint, low blood pressure, fainting that can occur. And the interaction with alcohol is one. It's not that the alcohol is the problem per se, but what it does is it helps maintain or increase the level of the drug in your bloodstream. So you're at higher risk of these possible side effects. And so that was indeed why FDA asked in the last cycle that they do a drug-alcohol interaction study. And basically what that is to say, okay, everyone comes, you know, it's sort of in a clinical trial setting, you're in a sort of hospital setting, clinic setting, where the patient takes the medication and then actually takes a couple of shots of alcohol right in a row, right, quite quickly to show, you know, just sort of as if you're, you know, having a, you know, at a party, having a couple of quick drinks. And about 20% of the patients in this study had to put their head between their knees, felt dizzy, had problems, and at least one of them, I believe, actually did black out during this study of 25 people. And here's the kicker. The study was done on 23 men and 2 women. I mean, this makes no sense, right? So why did they do it on 23 men and 2 women when this is a drug for women? And we know alcohol is metabolized differently in men than in women. It actually gets higher blood levels in women if you take the same amount of alcohol. And they argue that, oh, well, we didn't think to restrict it, and we had trouble recruiting women to come drink this much because women don't drink this much. You know, none of those arguments just don't hold water. And the fact that it is, this FDA is requiring, again, well, some of the restrictions on this approval, is that there must be some larger safety studies to be done now that it's approved, that have to be completed. And we'll look and see if how the safety issues actually play out. But I am not at all convinced that, you know, women who are on this are going to be counseled twice, in theory, not to drink.
Right. Well, they're supposed to.
And not just not to drink on the weekends and not to drink when you're. Just don't drink because you're taking this medication all the time. And therefore, your risk with the interaction of alcohol and other medications is all the time, not when you're, you know, thinking you're using it for, a sexual encounter. So it's just a, it's really actually quite worrisome.
Well, it's pretty surreal to expect that women who take the drug, they have to take it at bedtime and sign a waiver that they won't drink or take the pill. And I mean, this, how's this going to work in the real world?
I don't know. The PR campaign did put pressure both on the FDA advisory committee, the outside experts who were brought in for the meeting a couple of months ago, and pressure on the reviewers who were being accused of being sexist and discriminatory. And I think, as a personal view, that they probably felt that they don't think they're sexist. They're good people because these are the reviewers, you know, inside FDA who have supported access to all sorts of products for women and in their reproductive health, contraceptives and other medications for women. So I just can't imagine that public pressure didn't make them feel like they really needed to approve something.
But I don't understand.
Even under all this very restrictive regime that's being put out there.
Right, but I don't understand how you could do a test on a drug for women and only have one woman in the amongst.
Two. Of course, we're obviously done on women, but this alcohol interaction study was done on men.
But I'm surprised that you could get away with that, frankly. That it makes no sense.
Me too. I'm actually pretty shocked.
Right. So do you think then that obviously what's going on with Big Pharma is what Viagra is probably one of the most lucrative drugs in human history, right?
Right. Well, I don't know the figures, but I would assume so. It's certainly very popular.
Right. So this is what the motive is. Let's strike it gold with women, right?
I think so. I mean, the company has argued repeatedly that they don't plan to, you know, market it beyond this group of women who fit the definition as they've described it, and then and that they actually said they won't be doing any direct to consumer marketing for the first 18 months. I don't know if that was a requirement of FDA or that's being adopted voluntarily at the moment by the company, but that's what they say. They will not be advertising beyond it. But I cannot imagine that once this product is on the market in a long way, you know, that if it is successful, if they're able to get it past these restrictions and to make it into a lucrative market, that it won't be widely marketed and prescribed off-label. But we'll see.
Well, I guess this gets men off the hook, right? They don't have to.
Right.
Seduce a woman
it's not,
anymore.
It's not me, dear. Take go okay, have a pill. Yeah, exactly.
That's hardly a step forward. Well, Dr. Wood, I thank you so much for joining.
All right. Take care. Thank you.
You too. Bye-bye. Bye. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Susan Wood, who's a former FDA Assistant Commissioner for Women's Health. She is Associate Professor of Health Policy and of Environmental and Occupational Health and the Executive Director of the Jacobs Institute of Women's Health at George Washington University School of Public Health and Health Services. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back with an analysis of what seems to be a lackluster presidential campaign by Hillary Clinton. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is David Halperin, a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton, and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He also writes for Republic Report and The Huffington Post. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Halperin.
Thank you, Ian. How are you?
Very well, thanks. And although I must say, trying to follow this political race, even though we're over a year and a half or whatever it is from a year from November, the presidential elections, et cetera, there's an element of the theater of the absurd. I've just read a headline, Bobby Jindal blasts Scott Walker's health care plan as too liberal.
We're going to see a lot more of things like that.
Yeah. I mean, it's so surreal. So let me ask you, though, since you worked in the Clinton White Houses on the National Security Council, what's happening with Hillary Clinton? It seems like she's floundering. She doesn't seem to be able to get out from under the constant drumbeat of scandal, most of which is manufactured, which the press just keep latching on to. Meanwhile, the front runner on the Republican side, Donald Trump, he every day says something scandalous, which would be a career ender for anybody else, and scandal seems to roll off him like water off a duck's back.
Well, I think one of the issues is that Trump is putting himself before a Republican base that, frankly, is full of angry and gullible people. I mean, I just want to be honest about that. So they like someone who's a huckster, who offers, you know, and they don't like Washington. I don't blame them for that. I live in Washington. I don't like it at all. But that they could fall for somebody who really, to me, has the maturity of a child who's always engaged in score settling and in, you know, feuds, and someone whose policy prescriptions are frankly ridiculous and don't hold up at all, and whose values seem hateful. If that's the base that he is competing in, and he's doing pretty well, and I think it's just a sad comment about that base. I think Hillary Clinton has a tougher audience, which is both progressives and Democrats who are hoping to win, and a media that is just sort of learned to be professionally skeptical and in some ways hostile to the Clintons.
But in terms of a campaign, Bernie Sanders is doing incredibly well and drawing the biggest crowds of all candidates, almost all combined in some cases.
Yeah.
And there's a phenomenon going on there. And my question would be, David, is why, in terms of making these speeches, drawing these crowds, having these house parties, why isn't Hillary doing that?
I don't quite know. I think they are concerned about what happens when she interacts with the crowd, because the conservatives are gunning for Hillary Clinton. They're going to be trying to look for ways to embarrass her in public. There's a group of progressives who are gunning for Hillary Clinton and are not happy with a Clinton coronation. And she's not, frankly, for all her strengths, and I admire her very much, not the greatest person on her feet, not the greatest person in that kind of situation. And so I think they're worried about too much of that sort of face-to-face. And she's not amazing in a rally. I think they think that her style of doing this is just going to be different. And to be honest with you again, I think for all the talk of Trump and for all the talk of Hillary's troubles, I think what we're going to see is Hillary get the Democratic nomination. And on the Republican side, the money people, I always say the Republican Party's theme should be angry people and rich people coming together. The rich people win out over the angry people, as they usually do, and they will decide whether ultimately Jeb Bush can be saved or whether it's John Kasich or Chris Christie. But the money people will come together, and they'll figure out a way to run enough negative ads saying Donald Trump isn't a real Republican, and ultimately you will get Hillary versus the country club candidate. So for all the drama and all the fun, I'm sorry to say my view is that's where we'll end up.
Well, but curiously enough, the Fox debate, the first Republican presidential primary debate, was so rigged against Trump. It was obvious that Roger Ailes and Rupert Murdoch decided that this was their opportunity to kill off Trump and boost Jeb Bush. There's no question that that was their motive. And afterwards, the Frank Lutz so-called interaction with a hand-picked audience was so even more rigged. But what was interesting about it is that Trump actually beat them, beat Fox, because he refused to go on Fox after he felt he was badly treated. And he went on everybody else. And then Roger Ailes eventually had to call him up and beg him to go on Fox and not to organize a boycott against Fox with his hardcore followers who are all Fox viewers. So I must say that's a pretty extraordinary turn of events that Trump beat Ailes and Murdoch.
Well, he has good instinct for the room and for showmanship. He's a huckster. Look what he's associated with. I was reporting in the Wall Street Journal, the ACN company, which supposedly sells energy and online services, is just really a pyramid scheme. Trump was their spokesperson. Trump University, the for-profit college that Trump started, was a scam, reeling people in with seminars and having them pay $20,000, $30,000, and a lot of them saying they really got nothing for it. He's an entertainer. That was a great form for him, and Fox tried to trap him, but they should have known it was going to backfire. But again, I think that he cannot go much above what he's got now, because frankly, his views are a mishmash. His depth is very limited. I think in the end, again, the Republicans are not going to let this happen. But it is going to. I think they're going to have a struggle, but they're going to figure out a way ultimately to stop him.
So if we are finally to this sort of scandal-ridden tabloid headlines finally recede as this presidential primary progresses over these many, many months, David Halperin, do you expect, therefore, that as scandal and reality show insanity recedes, that substance and policy will come to the fore?
Oh no, I didn't say that. I think Trump's popularity is sort of about Trump's personality, but it also exposes a big angry part of the Republican base. People who really, really feel abused by this country, but whose solutions then turn towards the angry. Let's blame the immigrants. Let's not do anything that might promote peace in the world. Let's always go for confrontation. And never really blaming they'll say they're against big institutions, but then they get used by the party, which ultimately always turns to the interests of banks, insurance companies, oil companies, and the other people who are the big donors, because that's what the Republican Party actually is a conduit for money to control U.S. politics. So I don't think, and we'll also see whoever the nominees are, tons and tons of negative ads. And in some ways, I actually thought the last time Obama and Romney actually did get into some issues when they debated, and that some of the discussion was really about where the country should go. I'm not sure that but it was pretty weak. I think this time it'll be worse, because I think Trump has shown he shows politicians the advantages to being outrageous, to being irresponsible and unaccountable, and that in fact, creating kind of a race to the bottom, there's no integrity, people are going to do what they can to win, they're going to raise as much money as they can to win, I'm hopeful that frankly the Democrats win the election, because the Republicans have basically left America in terms of their views. But I don't think that they'll get there through a process that is very rational or very enlightening for the public.
So if Trump finally fades from the scene or fizzles, this is not before Governor Jeb Bush has fizzled. He's down 15% since the debate, and Walker is now tied for fifth place at 6%, down from 9%. And I mean, what's his name? The Libertarian. From
Rand Paul,
he's all but disappeared. I mean,
yeah.
Are you to believe any of these figures? This is basically winnowing that huge field.
It's a long way to go. I mean, when I, in 2004, 2003, 12 years ago, Howard Dean was way ahead in the Democratic poll. I went to work for Howard Dean, and immediately he went straight downhill. I hope not because of me, but probably. And by the time of the primary, I think the biggest thing that happened was a video leaked out of him saying that the Iowa caucuses were dominated by special interests and small-minded people or something like that. And then he immediately faded and lost Iowa. Then he let out a scream. So things can change. Things can change. And, again, I do think that Trump does show in some ways the fact that angry people are dominating the party and that angry sentiments dominate the party, but the money people in the party are probably going to figure out a way to neutralize that or to co-opt it. But they'll win. Whoever wins will win ugly by out-trumping Trump a little bit, while at the same time winking to all the established interests that they're going to be their boy when they become president, if they become president.
Well, returning to the Democrats and to get a sense of Bernie Sanders' surprising rise, he was not taken seriously, but an awful lot of people are taking him seriously, and he is drawing crowds, and he's not asking for money from the fat cats. He's asking from ordinary people, and it's coming in. And frankly, here in Los Angeles, he had a rally, 28,000 people, overflow crowd showed up. Most of the crowd were young and minorities, the very people that the Democrats need to win.
Yes. I'm concerned watching the video today of Hillary talking to the Black Lives Matter people that met her backstage, that video circulating today, that she was trying, but she wasn't quite doing it. And that, you know, while older African-Americans, I think, will be there for her, younger ones, I'm not sure that they, at this point, the way her campaign is, are going to turn out in the numbers that she needs to, I mean, they're not going to vote Republican. And to me, the question is whether they'll be inspired to vote at all. They voted for President Obama. Whether they'll vote for her, I think the campaign has to think more strategically and more practically about what it is they're offering to young African Americans and Latinos that will show them that it really is, which I think there is, a difference between the Democrat and the Republican parties. You know, maybe Bernie Sanders could do that if he were the nominee, but he's going to have a hard time with the group that Hillary kind of treads on both sides of, which are the money people. And at some point, the money people, you know, so some of them are never going to help the Democrats, but a lot of them in telecommunications and in Silicon Valley and other people, you know, have been willing to go with people like Clinton Obama. Whether they would say Bernie Sanders is better than the Republican, I'm not sure. And I'm not saying that he should appeal to those people. I'm just saying that is one reason he may have trouble winning the general as opposed to Hillary, which is that Hillary can bring in some of that money for the badly needed TV advertising and everything else that they're going to have to do to compete against the Republicans.
So you mentioned this private meeting that Hillary Clinton had backstage with Black Lives Matter protesters, and they had shut down a couple of Bernie Sanders rallies prior to that. My understanding is that the tape was leaked by them, I mean, by the Black Lives Matter people, as opposed to the Hillary. What's your understanding of the origins of this tape?
I just don't know.
Right. Well, then what was your impression of the tape?
She was pointing at them in a way that I think she got a little bit riled. I've had a chance to work with Hillary Clinton, and I think that, you know, there are few people in the country that, to me, ultimately would be more effective as an advocate for people of color, for low-income people, as president, would do more in terms of policies to make people's lives better, and including on addressing problems in the criminal justice system. In the Clinton, yes, she's being held accountable some for what the Clinton administration at the time. There was like a tough on crime, Democrats and Republicans competing to see who could give a higher sentence to somebody who was found with 5 grams of crack cocaine in their bag. So she has to be held accountable for that. I think she could be a good president for people who believe we need change, as I do, in our criminal justice system, in dealing with low-income people and the problems of people living in low-income communities, all of that. But I'm not sure yet that she's figured out how to convey that. When she made her announcement speech, my reaction was, that was a very good speech. It was forceful. It was passionate. It was her. And it really connected in New York. But, you know, since then, I haven't seen so much of that. I think that there's a gap between how good a person she is and how good a campaigner she is, and how effective a politician she could be and how good a campaigner she is. I'm positive on Hillary Clinton, but I'd like to think that the criticisms I've made of her in the past
our tough love. But the Clinton people, I'm afraid, you know, when I've had reactions to the things that very few things I've said about her that were even slightly negative, they said, how can you say this? My view is that she's probably surrounded too much by people who jump and don't want to question her and don't want to criticize her. And that's how she ended up with a private email server, frankly, which was a bad move from a policy perspective for various reasons, and a bad move ultimately from a political perspective. It's come back to haunt her. I don't think she was using her private email server in order to conceal information, but I think that for various reasons she thought that she could be held to a different standard. And that's hurt her. And I think she needs more people to stand up and say, you know, this was good, but here's how it could be a lot better. And these are things you need to do fundamentally you need to panic and throw your whole campaign in the wastebasket and start over because Bernie Sanders has gotten some good attention, is leading in some state polls. But you need to really kind of think about, you know, was your performance good in this event? Did you speak well? Did you do well in this exchange with the Black Lives Matter people? Do you have the right policies? I've seen some great policies from her. Today she came out against drilling in the Arctic. I think that's a great move for her and the right policy for our country. And I've seen it on a bunch of issues. She's taken on the for-profit colleges, as you know, an issue that I feel very strongly about, scam colleges that are ripping off our students and veterans. She spoke very strongly about that. She's got a great set of policies, but needs a better campaign and a little bit better sensibility, I think, about how to reach out to voters and especially to get those young young voters and voters of color.
Well, what you're saying there, David, is pretty much the criticism of the campaign that she ran against Barack Obama. And the guy that ran that campaign was universally condemned, and he got paid a fortune, I understand. And that leads you to question her judgment. Do you think she's got good people handling her campaign in this time around?
I think she's got some fantastic people handling her campaign. Quite a few of them I know well and have worked with over the years. But you know, ultimately, the performance has to be hers, and whether what they're saying to her is, you know, tough enough advice, and whether she's getting it and translating it, I'm not so sure. And I think that, you know, there's always room for improvement in a campaign, including in hers. But ultimately, it is her, and, you know, leadership isn't just about things that a good candidate can be a good president. A lot of the skills are the same. And maybe she can rise to the occasion and do that. I believe very strongly she is going to be the nominee. And I think then she has a good chance to win because a good part of the country is committed Democrat and is not going to vote for whoever the Republican nominee is. There's a group of independents up for grabs. I think she has a chance to do it. But again, I think that she needs to keep on thinking about not only who are the right people to help her and who are the wrong people who shouldn't be there, but also how can she rise above? How can she really be that person? I know she's a great person, and I know she's a person who can rise above special interests and really do the right thing for this country. And she's got to find that core, and she's got to convey it, and she hasn't done it yet.
Well, David Halpern, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Ian, for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with David Halpern, who's a senior fellow at Republic Report. He was previously founding director of Campus Progress and a senior vice president at the Center for American Progress, senior policy advisor for Howard Dean's presidential campaign, founding executive director of the American Constitution Society, White House speechwriter and special assistant for national security affairs to President Clinton and counsel to the Senate Intelligence Committee. He also writes for Republic Report and the Huffington Post. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.